ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good evening and welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, NAPLAN results show a third of Australian students are failing to meet literacy and numeracy standards. Are computers and AI to blame? Also, the New South Wales Premier criticises the appearance of lawyers for Palestinian groups at the Royal Commission on Anti-Semitism. And the prospect of a SpaceX rocket crashing onto the moon reignites the debate about space junk.
As we launch more and more stuff towards the moon, then the likelihood that your launcher is going to be on a trajectory that's going to collide with the moon will increase.
At the Royal Commission on Anti-Semitism and Social Cohesion, a heated debate has broken out over the appearances of lawyers acting for pro-Palestinian groups. The New South Wales Premier, Chris Minns, has described as disappointing the Commission's decision to allow the lawyers to ask a witness about Israel's conduct. There's also been criticism of the Commission's approach from Liberal Senator James Patterson and a senior Jewish leader. But the Royal Commissioner, Virginia Bell, has hit back at those critics. Our senior correspondent Barbara Miller has been at the hearing in Sydney today. Barb, the lawyers for the pro-Palestinian groups appeared yesterday. So how has this controversy unfolded?
Well, at issue is the appearance of lawyers for two pro-Palestinian groups. That's the Australia-Palestine Advocacy Network, or APAN, and the Palestine Action Group. And yesterday, they had some testy exchanges with the witness, David Ossip. He's the president of the New South Wales Jewish Board of Deputies. And they were pressing him on Israel's conduct and Palestinian death tolls. Now, following those exchanges yesterday, Alex Rivchin from the Executive Council of Australian Jewry was quoted in The Australian as saying that those lawyers were hijacking the commission with, and I quote, clickbait theatrics and gratuitous slurs against Israel. And the commission heard today from the commissioner that following those quotes attributed to Alex Rivchin, the APAN lawyer Ragni Mather was subjected to a series of abusive Islamophobic emails. Commissioner Virginia Bell condemned that abuse. And she said, Sam, that the lawyer was granted leave to appear as a matter of procedural fairness.
Ms. Mather did not hijack this royal commission. Ms. Mather was appearing for an organisation whose interests were substantially and directly affected by the subject matter of yesterday's hearing, in that trenchant criticism was being made of the representatives of that organisation.
Now, the questioning by the lawyers for the pro-Palestinian groups has also come in for some pretty heavy criticism from the New South Wales Premier, Chris Minns. In written comments, the Premier said, the idea that the focus shifted from anti-Semitism in Australia to testing a witness on foreign policy is disappointing and doesn't reflect the purpose of these hearings. And the Liberal Senator James Patterson has also weighed in, saying the Royal Commission is supposed to combat anti-Semitism, not facilitate it, also critical of that cross-examination.
Among those appearing before the commission today, I understand, was a former neo-Nazi. What was his evidence?
Yes, he appeared anonymously and he told the commission he joined a neo-Nazi group in the early 2000s. He says he was attracted to the group. The members were fit and they were educated. He also at that point held anti-immigrant views, he said in part because they were passed on by his mother, and also because of an incident where he says he was assaulted by a member of an ethnic community. He eventually walked away for good from the neo-Nazi group on a second attempt to disengage. And he said that was after positive experiences with ethnic minorities and a feeling that he wanted to be involved with something good and not something bad.
Well, in these groups, the line is sold to you that you are the good guys. You know, you're striving for the Great White Hope, things like that. But once you get exposed to things outside, you start to see, and especially with interactions with different people, you start to see that in society, you're actually the bad guys. And in different circumstances, I'd had people, you know, explain to me that they would rather hang out with a murderer than with someone like me.
And Sam, this kind of evidence is at the heart of the focus of this block of hearings, which kicked off today, into drivers of extremism and anti-Semitism and responses to it, including strategies for de-radicalisation.
Our senior correspondent Barbara Miller reporting from the Royal Commission on Anti-Semitism and Social Cohesion in Sydney. Today's NAPLAN results are raising concerns for educators and peak groups invested in Australia's growth and success. NAPLAN is the National Assessment Program for Literacy and Numeracy. Each year it tests more than a million students in years 3, 5, 7 and 9. The latest figures show a third of Australian students aren't meeting, quote, challenging but reasonable expectations in literacy and numeracy. And about 10% of those kids are so far behind the expected standards, they need extra help. Professor Greg Thompson was a teacher in WA. He's now the director of the Institute for Learning Sciences and Teacher Education at the Australian Catholic University. Professor Thompson, how are you interpreting today's NAPLAN results?
So from reviewing the results, the first thing that sort of leaps out is the finding across all years, year 3, year 5, year 7 and year 9, that in general there's been negligible change, as ACARA calls it, in 2026. And that negligible change is in comparison to between 2025 and 2026, but also from results in 2023, 2024, 2025 and 2026. So results have stayed largely the same. What's important about that is that these fairly stable results are occurring at the subgroup level. It's not just state averages on comparison or the national average that stayed the same across each of those year levels. It's also at the subgroup, which includes the kind of data that ACARA collects around school system, the socioeconomic status of the schools and the students, whether people are in remote, regional or urban communities, and so on.
So which subgroups are raising alarm bells for you?
Traditionally, over a long period of time in Australia, we've become aware that there are some groups, right, who are experiencing, you know, a difference in outcomes. And these tend to be people who are in regional and remote Australia. They tend to be people who come from low socioeconomic backgrounds. They also, you know, there are state-based differences and also people who perhaps don't have English, you know, as a first language in some instances. And if the results at the subgroup are showing negligible change, it shows that those groups are still, you know, not performing at the level that would show that we have an equitable education system.
On those points you just raised, I was interested to see in the NAPLAN figures that one of the groups that's actually doing quite well is the children of migrants. What would you put that down to?
One of the things that there has been some research that's been done out of the University of Queensland that suggests that one of the things that happens with migrants is Australia has a skilled migrant uptake. So often, you know, some of the people who are coming in can be people who from their original country had educated parents and weren't coming from complex backgrounds, so to speak.
Professor Thompson, in light of the results, I noted the Queensland Education Minister is calling for a back-to-basics approach. The New South Wales Education Minister is mulling having students in years 5, 7 and 9 going back to pen and paper NAPLAN tests rather than being on the computer. Do you think a reliance on technology is stymieing children's learning?
There's really two parts to that question. So the first part is, when they shifted the tests online, has there been shown to be a systematic difference in student achievement? And the answer is not really. The second part of the question is whether, you know, students doing a lot of learning on time, particularly in the age of generative AI, could be something which is, you know, problematic for student achievement. And I think this is something we really need to sort of, you know, think about. It's too early to say that generative AI is really sort of, you know, impacting NAPLAN results, partly because of the fact that they've remained fairly stable since 2023, okay, which is, you know, before, you know, ChatGPT, et cetera, became a feature in so many young people's orbits. So I think there are many, many sort of dangers that we want to sort of be aware of and think about. And there's two obvious ones. You know, the first one is this idea of what they call cognitive offloading, which is that, you know, learning is meant to be effortful, okay, and we learn best where we are challenged and sort of overcome challenges. If we just easily park that off to some, you know, generative AI bot, that can actually have long-term sort of effects on people, you know, young people's interest and capacity to do some of the cognitive work required. And the second reason that we might be a little concerned is I read a post this week that said that, you know, the AI bot Claude, right, that was the number one user of it was in Australia, and the number one prompt, okay, was homework. So if homework is something that is being outsourced to generative AI as well, that may have sort of long-term consequences for young people. But as I said, it's early days and we need to watch this very, very closely in the context not just of NAPLAN, but in school performance and student achievement in general.
Professor Greg Thompson from the Australian Catholic University. The Federal Energy Minister has announced the government will expand its rooftop solar rebate scheme to include some public and commercial buildings. In a speech to the National Press Club, Chris Bowen observed that warehouses, school buildings, factories and farm sheds have been missing out on the rollout of rooftop solar. The broader scheme will include installations of up to 1 megawatt. Rachel Mealy has more.
Apart from when it's raining cats and dogs, the Brimbank Veterinary Clinic in Sydenham in northwest Melbourne runs on solar.
We first started installing solar in 2014. And gradually expanded to, by 2020, we'd covered our entire roof and now have a 30-kilowatt solar system.
Vet Jeremy Watson is one of the owners of the business.
We use most of our power during the daytime, so it makes sense to take advantage of all the solar power that we generate. One initial thing was we decided to get off gas, and so we simply just stopped using our gas heating and used our reverse cycle aircon to heat the place, and actually found that our bills went down just because gas is too expensive now and we're taking advantage of the cheap solar power. So we then did the same with our hot water and our industrial clothes dryer, and so we've now gone to all electric and continue to get savings. So that's been a big bonus for the practice.
Energy Minister Chris Bowen says businesses like the Brimbank Vet Practice are the missing link in the chain for solving Australia's energy needs. He's announced the expansion of the government's small-scale renewable energy scheme from 100 kilowatts to 1 megawatt.
This will slash the installation cost for commercial, industrial and agricultural buildings by around 20%. That's a significant saving on an investment that will immediately begin lowering the cost of energy for those companies and businesses.
It's a move that's been welcomed by the Australian Chamber of Commerce and Industry, which says that of the roughly 28 gigawatts of installed capacity, only 5 or 6 gigawatts comes from business premises. Chief Executive Andrew McKellar says he expects Australian business owners will make use of the rebate.
So we really think, you know, whether it's a small or medium-sized business, if you've got a reasonable area of roof space. Of course, you know, some businesses are already doing that anyway, but by no means all. I think there's there's significant upside in terms of the new capacity that can be installed. So I think it's a new frontier, and I think many businesses will be quite keen to have a look at this opportunity.
Francis Vierboom is the chief executive of Rewiring Australia. He says the expansion of the rebate system will allow more communities to generate and use affordable electricity locally.
There's an enormous amount of roof space in Australia that we have on our factories, on our warehouses, on our sheds, and a lot of this is in cities where we need the energy. Over the next 10 to 20 years, we've got a lot of EV chargers to build into the places where people are driving around. We're going to start seeing electric dump trucks on mine sites. We're going to start seeing electric tractors in our farms. And these kind of big solar facilities are going to be really useful for powering those big electricity customers of the future.
But he says it's not just the businesses making the decision to expand. There also needs to be speedier connections to the grid.
Our homes have benefited from the fact that it only takes like 2 weeks to add a rooftop solar system onto the grid. But if you want to build a bigger system, if you're running a factory-sized solar system, sometimes you're in a queue for 3 months or 6 months, or I've even heard of like a year and a half, people are waiting. So there's a big job to do to make the connection process streamlined. And it's really important that our electricity networks realize that part of their job isn't just keeping the lights on, but it's actually connecting up thousands and millions of new devices that are going to be running on electricity over the next couple of decades.
Francis Veerboom is the chief executive of renewable energy advocacy firm Rewiring Australia. That report from Rachel Mealy. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on ABC Listen. Anti-domestic violence campaigners are urging the federal government to reform the family law system by giving children more of a voice in custody disputes. As the nation moves to the second phase of the federal government's plan to end violence against women and children by 2032, the Attorney General Michelle Rowland has confirmed she is exploring that possibility. Kimberly Price has this report.
When Connor Paul was a child, his parents separated, and the mediation process forced him to live with the very person he wanted to escape from.
If I wasn't placed into the perpetrator's care, I wouldn't have had a childhood that was plagued with family violence. And we have hundreds of thousands of children and young people with very similar stories to my own.
Now 23 years old, Connor Paul is still making sense of the violence he experienced. As a youth engagement and advocacy leader at the Australian Childhood Foundation, he is urging for children to be given a voice in mediation and family court cases under the Family Law Act.
The federal government has said that they want to put children and young people at the centre of family law. And the family court. But I think what people forget is that you can put someone at the centre of a room and still only talk about and around them.
Connor Paul believes more time is needed within the system to allow a child to feel safe enough to disclose their experiences and wants greater supports for young people after a court case has closed.
And we really need to be having a hard look at the fact that the right to live a safe and free life is a right that's inherently held by everyone, including children and young people.
Dr. Georgina Dimopoulos is an Associate Professor of Law at Southern Cross University. She agrees there needs to be greater emphasis on a child's experience.
From the research I've done, 9 out of the 41 children and young people I spoke with did disclose that they had chosen to intentionally not comply with the parenting orders. And so one young person said, well, if they're not going to listen to me, I'm not going to listen to them.
Georgina Dimopoulos says there's momentum from those within the family court system to engage with children in a more meaningful way. However, ultimate reform needs to be legislated by the federal government.
I would say that the recent reforms, the Family Law Amendment Act 2023, was a missed opportunity for that.
After interviewing 94 people who have been through the family court system and practitioners working with victim survivors of family violence, industry professor at the University of Technology Sydney and advocate Jess Hill believes drastic reform is needed.
One of the mothers we interviewed for our study, she had to mediate with her ex-partner while he was in prison because he'd breached bail for 11 charges of really intense violence against her.
The majority of cases that come before the family court involve family violence or child abuse, and Jess Hill argues the court isn't properly set up to probe these cases.
A lot of those matters are coming to light for the first time through a family court application, and there is no investigative body that sits within or alongside the court that can reliably investigate and develop the facts to put before the court.
She argues, along with developing a child-focused court system, the second phase of the national plan to end violence against women and children should establish investigative judicial powers.
Federally funded National Child and Family Assessment Service that would investigate these cases and form an evidence brief for the courts so that safe decisions can be made. We need greater scrutiny and transparency over systems that have for too long been allowed to do harm.
A spokesperson for Attorney General Michelle Rowland says the Federal Circuit and Family Court of Australia has a range of measures in place to handle cases involving family violence and child abuse, and the government remains committed to exploring opportunities to further support children's participation through family law policy reform.
Kimberly Price. And if you or anyone you know needs help, you can call the National Family Violence Counselling Service, 1-800-RESPECT. That's 1-800-737-732. If it's an emergency, call 000. A piece of a SpaceX rocket the size of a bus is on a collision course with the moon. Astronomers realised earlier this year the debris was on that trajectory, with Elon Musk's SpaceX no longer able to control it. Alexandra Humphreys filed this report.
3, 2, 1, ignition. And liftoff. Go, ISpace. Go.
When SpaceX's Falcon 9 launched towards the moon in January last year, the second stage of the rocket was left floating in space. Until now.
What has happened is essentially a mixture of solar activity and gravity forces have put it on a path towards the moon.
Juliana Sheeman is the SpaceX director of NASA Science and Dragon programs. She says the company is now working on ways to prevent similar incidents.
One of the things that we're working in partnership with NASA and the other appropriate agencies is what is the best future disposal path for high energy missions that are in a, you know, the Sun, Earth, Moon system.
The 4-ton piece of rocket the size of a school bus has been hurtling towards the moon at more than 8,000 kilometres per hour.
It's rather careless of SpaceX to let their rocket crash into the moon.
Tamara Davis is a professor of astrophysics at the University of Queensland.
Usually when things launch, the stages of the rocket will fall back to Earth, burn up in the atmosphere, and or leave some debris perhaps in the ocean, not make too much of a problem. As we launch more and more stuff towards the moon, as opposed to just into low Earth orbit or into some other orbits, then the likelihood that your launcher is going to be on a trajectory that's going to collide with the moon will increase. This is something that we really can't make a habit of if we intend to keep launching stuff to land on the moon.
This afternoon's impact on the moon wasn't expected to be visible in Australia. But another unusual phenomenon has night sky watchers talking in Tasmania.
I could see them as clear as, and there can be up to 6, with very bright lights that sort of disappear and reappear, and they move at 90-degree angles.
Wayne Johnston is the mayor of the regional Tasmanian Council of Meander Valley in the state's north. For over a month, he's been seeing unusual lights darting across the night sky. They appear almost like embers, rapidly changing direction and disappearing. And he has no idea what they are.
Pretty much every clear night since, from about 8 o'clock to 9 o'clock, there are lights up in the sky around the Western Tiers.
They've been spotted in other parts of the state too.
We've made inquiries to anybody that has commercial drones or the police or Parks and Wildlife or anybody, and there's just nobody can tell us what they are.
Paris Butfield Addison is the co-founder of the West Coast Space Centre, and he may have the answer. And it's not a UFO.
That it's probably sunlight glinting off Starlink satellites. The newest Starlink satellites, particularly the very new models of them, very much catch the sun, and then they flare out in the direction of the sun. And because this is kind of shortly after sunset and before sunrise, this very much matches what people keep describing. There's actually a formal US government report about how Starlink satellites, which is, they call it flaring, flares off the satellites, get mistaken for UFOs all the time.
Professor Tamara Davis again.
People are worried, actually, that our sky will become so contaminated with satellites that it will be hard to see the stars. There's so many of these getting launched now that it's becoming a real problem for astronomical observations, because you get the streaks of these bright satellites passing through your observations and destroying what you're trying to look at in the background. So it's something that astronomers are really concerned about.
As the SpaceX company reveals its revenue and spending have risen significantly over the past year, the impacts of space exploration are being felt near and far.
Alexandra Humphreys reporting. Thanks for being with me for PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. The podcast of the full program is available on ABC Listen. And that's where you'll find ABC News Daily with Sam Hawley each weekday morning too. PM will be back at the same time tomorrow. Good night.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. For years, we managed to avoid it. The H5 strain of the bird flu virus is now taking hold, and so much of our wildlife is at risk. Today, epidemiologist Rainer McIntyre, who studied bird flu for almost 30 years, on how the virus could reach poultry and potentially dairy farms with devastating outcomes. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on ABC Listen.